Okay, so I guess we can start the talk. My voice is a little bit hoarse tonight because I'm having a little bit of a cold, so hopefully it won't come across too badly. We'll see what happens as we go along here. But the topic for tonight's talk is the future of Buddhism. And I thought it would be interesting to have a look at some of the things that Buddha has to say about this, and what that consequences of that for our modern practice of Buddhism. What does it actually mean when we look at what the Buddha said about these things? One of the strange things you may hear about prophecies, right, that are made about Buddhism. You may have heard of a book. There's a book by Ayakema, one of the very famous nuns who started the nuns' monastic order back in the 1988, actually, one of the very first bhikkhunis in the Theravada tradition. And she had a book that was called When the Iron Eagle Flies. And of course, the idea of the Iron Eagle seems to have been a prediction that in the future there would be things like planes, right? The Iron Eagle is obviously a plane. So When the Iron Eagle Flies was the title of one of her books. And this was a prediction about the future of Buddhism. And there is also quite a well-known book in the Theravada tradition called the Anagatavamsa, which means the future, the lineage of the future. And it talks about all the Buddhas of the future, this line of Buddhas, one after the other. So again, there is this interest about the future of Buddhism. It's one of those things that people get very excited about and very interested in. And then things about this, which also is very interesting, is that when you go to the actual suttas, when you go to what the Buddha taught about this, he doesn't really make any predictions about the future at all. He has a very different approach to this. He looks on the future in a very different way. And what the Buddha says, instead of making predictions about the futures, what he says is that there are these things that we need to do. There are certain things that we should do to actually ensure the long-term survival of Buddhism in the future. What do we need to do to ensure that Buddhism prospers, that we have a Buddhism which lasts for a long time for the benefit and well-being of many people? So it's a very different angle, right? One is like speculation about the future, what is going to happen, trying to look into the crystal ball, right, and seeing all kind of weird stuff which may be there, may not be there. And the other one is the pragmatic approach. What do we actually need to do so that we ensure the long-term survival of Buddhism in the future? And to me, this is very telling, this difference between these two things. Because why is it that people are so interested in the future of Buddhism? What is the reason for that? And I think the reason for that is is fairly obvious. It is a fear of losing something very precious in one's life. If you find the Buddhist path, or you find a spiritual path which is very meaningful for you, which you feel supports you, which lends you that wisdom that you need from time to time to be able to practice in the right way, that helps you to solve the problems in life, that kind of carries you forward, increases your happiness and reduces your suffering. If you find something like that in your life, and you're about to lose it, you become scared, right? You see the decline of Buddhism around you, you see people dying, you see all these kind of things. And of course, from that fear, from that desire for having the same thing in the future, often arises this feeling, this necessity of trying to predict what is going to happen to Buddhism. So I think it's a very natural psychological thing that we are inclined in that direction. So we think about those things in this way. And just imagine what would happen to the Buddhist society here if Ajahn Brahm died, for example. Well, he's going to die one day, right? So might as well get used to it. But what's going to happen if he dies, if he passes away? Is the Buddhist society going to be the same without Ajahn Brahm? I can guarantee you it's not going to be the same without him. Some things are going to change, right? And for many people, when you think about it, it's a bit of a scary prospect. Buddhist society with Ajahn Brahm. Are we going to survive? What's going to happen next? And it all kind of seems a bit scary because of that. And if you look back in history and you look back to the time when the Buddha was passing away, the Buddha's passing away is taught at length in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Sutta, the discourse, the great discourse on the Buddha's passing away. And there, towards the very end of the Buddha's life, he's kind of lying down between two trees, right? And this is out near a town called Kusinara. And if you go to Kusinara in the present day, you can go there in India, and you can actually see the stupas and the kind of temple that has been built up around that site. We know pretty much exactly where the Buddha passed away, even today here. And if you go there near this place where the Buddha was passing, it was a town. Kusinara was the capital city of a republic called the Malian Republic. And all the people would come out from the city and pay their respect to the Buddha. And then, as the night progressed, things became more and more peaceful. And eventually, the Buddha passed away. And what was the response of the people? People were crying and they were wailing. The gods were coming, right? Everybody was tearing out their hair and beating their breast and saying, "Too soon, too soon, the eye of the world has passed away." Right, this is what happens. Here is the Buddha, you can imagine, one of the most charismatic, one of the most powerful spiritual teachers in the history of mankind. And you all rely on somebody like that, right? And then he passes away. Imagine the vacuum. Imagine the hole that is created when somebody like that passes away. And people saying, "Too soon, the eye of the world has passed away." I like this, a very beautiful epithet of the Buddha, the eye of the world, because the point is, the Buddha sees, the Buddha gains awakening, he understands the world as it actually is, and then he passes that information on to other people, so they too can see the same thing. In that sense, he is the eye of the world that then helps you to also open your eyes. The eye of the world has passed away, what shall we do? And what people do, they start speculating about the future, right? What's going to happen next? How long is Buddha going to last? Is it going to last 500 years or 5,000 years? Some places says 500, other places says 5,000. What is going to happen next? How are we going to be able to deal with this tragic moment? So this is one way of dealing with it, trying to speculate about the future, trying to read some kind of security, a sense of safety. Yes, things will be okay because Buddhism will be around for a long time. When I die, my next life, I will also be a Buddhist. I will continue the practice as a consequence. And in this way, I will just keep going from life to life and there won't be a problem. So this is one way of dealing with this, that dealing with things coming from fear, coming from a sense of insecurity, because life is, after all, inherently insecure. But there's another way of dealing with this, which I think is really the Dhamma way, the way that the Buddha would have encouraged us to deal with these kind of things. And that is to understand that this is the nature of things. Things are impermanent. The Buddha must pass away. Ajahn Brahm must pass away. The Buddha society here must pass away. Everything must change. Buddhism itself must one day pass away. And when you understand the impermanence of things, the insecurity, the unreliability of things, instead of wailing and being sad, you say, "This is my opportunity. Now is my chance to do the practice. Now I have the teachings right here in front of me. I have the good teachers. Now is the time to do the practice." Right? That is the right way here, to arouse in yourself the sense of urgency because things are so inherently uncertain in the way they are. So this is the right way. But of course, instead of doing that, very often people instead, they try to predict the future. And one of these interesting predictions, of course, and this is a prediction partially based on reality, on the way that Buddhism works, and this is the prediction that there will be future Buddhas. Right? There will be future Buddhas. Okay, there will be future Buddhas. Okay, that's pretty cool, isn't it? If there will be future Buddhas, it means I can relax in this life, because in this life, I don't feel quite ready. And but if I kind of, if I hang around and I do the right things, I will be reborn. When there's a future Buddha, then I can continue my practice. Right? Sounds good. You have a future Buddha. Somebody's going to come around. And of course, the consequences of these kind of predictions. And these predictions don't really originate from our Buddha, the Buddha Gautama. They originate from a later kind of period of Buddhism. But of course, the consequence of those kind of predictions is that if you feel, and many people feel, that Buddhism is declining in the world, we don't know if it's possible to practice the right way. So instead, let's go out and worship this future Buddha instead. The Buddha Maitreya, when he arises sometime in the future, we will be ready because we have worshipped him. We have built these enormous statues of the Buddha Maitreya. And we have done all those things to get ready for the future Buddha. Is that a wise approach to Buddhism? Is that the right way of doing things? Is that the way of overcoming our insecurity and the inherent unreliability of things? And of course the answer is absolutely not. This is really silly. And yet you find that there are so many Buddhists around the world who do just that. One of the things many of you may have seen is this little Buddha statues, the Chinese Buddha statues. May have seen them, the laughing Buddha. Those are the ones with the big belly, right? You rub the belly for good luck and this kind of thing. So, now this is a very, very common, is maybe one of the most common of the Chinese Buddha statues. What is that Buddha statue? In Chinese it's called Mi Le Fo. Fo is the Chinese word for Buddha, and Mi Le is the Chinese word for Maitreya. So this actually is Maitreya Buddha, according to the Chinese tradition. The Buddha, the laughing Buddha with a big belly. And that, of course, has completely penetrated Chinese culture. It has become so mainstream that the most famous of all the Chinese Buddha is precisely this Mi Le Fo. So this is how important it has become. And yet, is it really the right way? Is it appropriate for us to worship this future Buddha? Who is this future Buddha anyway? When is he going to be around? What is he going to look like? What is he going to teach? Are we going to be here when the Buddha comes around? It's just so uncertain, right? Is this pie in the sky? Is this kind of mental castle that we have built up for ourselves, which doesn't really have any basis in reality at all? Yes, we know from Buddhist ideas that the idea of a Buddha, the Buddha is like a natural phenomenon that will arise in the world every now and again. We know that because this is what Buddhas basically are. They arise every now and again. So we know, no doubt, there will be future Buddhas. But we don't know anything about this person. We don't even know if it's going to be male or female, or it's going to be born in, the Earth or Mars, but hopefully it's going to be on Earth. But we know so little about this person, right? How can you worship something? How can you put your faith in something which is so incredibly uncertain? And I think even, I would go so far as to say here, that it actually is disrespectful. It's disrespectful of our present Buddha, the Buddha Gautama, the one who has given us all these wonderful and powerful teachings that are still available to us. They are there, right? The practice is available to us. We can read all those suttas, all those discourses by the Buddha. How can we then go and worship something else when the Buddha who has given us the true teaching is still around? It's actually disrespectful, and it's the wrong way of going about this. So I would say to all Buddhists in the world, please don't worship the so-called future Buddha Maitreya that we don't know anything about. Forget about that. Leave it aside. It's completely irrelevant to our Buddhist practice. What we need to do is to fulfill that practice which is available to us right here, right now. So this is one of those things, one of those dangers about prophesizing the future, trying to understand the future. Instead of applying ourselves in the present moment, we kind of get carried away by these kind of ideas in our mind, these pies in the sky, which there's no tangible evidence for at all in the present day. So please don't fall for that kind of danger. Now one of the things that this is one important topic in its own right. One of the other things that I wanted to talk about tonight, which I also think is quite topical right now, is one of the things that has been in the news quite a bit. And I think it shows us quite nicely how we can apply the Buddha's teachings in the right way. How we can use those teachings by looking at what the Buddha said about safeguarding the future and use that to actually apply that to problems in the present day, in the present age. And one of the things that the Buddha said, which is very useful to remember, he said there are seven things that we need to know or seven things that are especially important for preserving Buddhism in the future. And one of those seven things, which I think is very significant and which is often forgotten in the entire Buddhist world, is that the Buddha said, those things that have been laid down by the Buddha, those things we should keep. And those things that have not been laid down by the Buddha, we should not lay down new rules or new ideas based on our own understanding here. Right? So we should keep what is there. We should base our faith, base our confidence on those things that have been taught by the Buddha, both in terms of his the Vinaya. The Vinaya is really the code of conduct of the monastics. It's actually quite interesting, that code of conduct. It has a lot of aspects to it, not just rules of behavior, but also how a community of monastics should function and work together. This is actually very fascinating. I will talk a little bit more about that later on, how the monastic community functions, how it's governed, how it actually works. A very interesting area which isn't talked about very often. So there are all these rules, all these things laid down by the Buddha. And the Buddha says, keep those things, don't make new ones. And what do we do as Buddhists? What is the first thing that we start to do as soon as the Buddha has passed away? As soon as the Buddha has passed away, we start building up new things, right? New rules, new regulations, new kind of scriptures, right? The Abhidhamma comes soon after the Buddha. This is the real Buddhism. We have extracted the essence of the Buddha's teachings. This is called the Abhidhamma. This is what you should be studying here. I'm not joking. This is actually how it is said, right? If you go around the Buddhist world, people will say the essence of the Buddhist teachings is found in the Abhidhamma. This is the highest expression of the Buddhist teachings. Read this and you'll be fine here. So this is what happens in the Buddhist world, and this is how things tend to go. And this one thing that I was just mentioning before that has been in the news recently, and this has mostly been in the news on kind of Buddhist kind of media, but it also penetrated a little bit into the broader media in general around the world. And this is succession of the Sangha Raja, the head of the Sangha, the head of the monastic order in Thailand. I don't know if you've seen that. It actually penetrated into the worldwide media, which is quite astonishing. So why has this succession of the Sangha Raja, Sangha Raja literally means the king of the Sangha, right? The head, the big boss. Why has that made so much ripples that it has actually come into mainstream Western media? What is going on here? Now, what is going on there is that because of the hierarchical nature of Thai Buddhism, very, very hierarchical, with the Sangha Raja on top and kind of these layers going down, because of that, this position as head of the Sangha is very prestigious, right? If you get to that position, you become very powerful. You can become very wealthy. You have all this kind of influence on what is going on. So, and many people who have kind of supported you, you know, over the decades, over the years, they are keen to have you in power, because if they have you in power, you will do their bidding in power and you will support them. So lots of jostling to get these kind of positions. But of course, this one person who was suggested to be the Sangha Raja of Thailand, now the problem with him was that he had this antique Mercedes, right? This is the head monk of Thailand, great example, right? He had an antique Mercedes worth about $250,000, right? The head of the Sangha Raja, and he was arguing his case. No, it wasn't really his. He had given it away to a museum. I think the museum was in the monastery. It's kind of weird to have a museum with an old Mercedes in the monastery, right? But anyway, be that as it may. So they have this investigation. It was a big scandal in Thailand. So they're trying to investigate, trying to find out, is this monk really a good monk? Is he worthy to be the head of the Sangha of Thailand if he collects antique Mercedeses? Is that kind of the main job of monastics, to collect antique Mercedeses? And of course, it's very valid, right? These kind of questions are very important. And these questions need to be asked. So what is the answer then? How do we deal with that kind of situation in the real world? And the way things have been happening in Thailand, the monks have been coming out, right? Some have been supporting him, some have been in opposition to him. They have been clashing with the police, right? And of course, the lay boys have been up in arms. How can the monks and the police fight each other? This doesn't look very good, good for the rest of the world. But this is what happens when you have power struggles, right? Not all monks are involved, but a small minority is. So how do we deal with these kind of things? What do we do in this kind of situation when it looks like Buddhism is falling apart, Buddhism is corrupt? How do we kind of bring it back on the tracks again, so we kind of head in the right direction, which ideally is towards more integrity, more morality, more kindness, etc., and all these kind of things? And of course, the answer from my point of view is always go back to the source. Go back to the Buddha. What does the Buddha have to say about this? If you really have faith, if you have confidence in the vision of the Buddha, and I have very firm confidence in the fact that the Buddha knew what he was talking about, we should ask, how would the Buddha have solved this kind of situation? And to understand that, one of the interesting things perhaps here is to understand a little bit about the history of how these things have come about. Why is it that the Thai Sangha is so hierarchical? How have we gotten to this stage where the Sangha is so different from how it was actually established by the Buddha 2,500 years ago? And the history behind that is basically goes back to a very famous Thai king called King Mongkut, who lived in the first half of the 19th century, and for two decades in the middle of the 19th century, he was the king of Thailand. And he was a very famous king, rightly so, because he was reformist, he wanted to reform the Sangha, he saw the corruption around him, right? There's always been corruption in the Sangha, there's always corruption everywhere. This is just the nature of life. So he saw the corruption, he saw that the monastics weren't really doing what they should be doing, nobody really understood the word of the Buddha, so he wanted to reform it, he wanted to bring it back to a more pristine ideal of the Sangha, more in line with how the Buddha had taught. This is very laudable, right? This is the top of the Sangha in Thailand, the king of Thailand. And before he became the king, he was a monk for about 10 years, something like that. So he saw the Sangha firsthand. He knew exactly what was going on. He had inquired from all the meditation masters at the time to find out about Buddhism, find out about meditation, and couldn't really get any good answers from the Sangha around him. But this time in Thai society was also a time, we're talking about the mid-19th century, and of course at that time was a time when the British Empire was almost at its peak, right? The sun never sets on the British Empire, 25% of the world was kind of ruled by the British or whatever. It was almost at the height of the British Empire. And of course, because the British had been so successful, apparently successful, maybe we should say, or whatever it is, and maybe some other colonial powers from Europe also had been so apparently successful, of course, many of these Asian countries, they looked to the British way, to the Western way of doing things, and were asking themselves, how can we change Thai society? How can we reform things so that we get some of that understanding which is available in Western society? They were thinking about the scientific understanding, but they were also looking at the Western way of governing things, right? So what this King Mongkut did when he was looking out into the world trying to figure out how the Western society operates, his ideal for how to reform the Sangha was the Catholic Church. Right? So he looked at the Catholic Church, he thought, wow, this is a very efficient organization, right? Very wealthy, very powerful, and most importantly, very, very hierarchical, right? The Pope on the top, the cardinals, the bishops, the priests, or whatever, one layer after the other, everything very controlled, everything centralized in the Vatican in Rome, with the Pope kind of controlling the whole thing here. So he looked at the Western idea of the Catholic Church is organized, and then decided that this should be the model for how we should organize the Sangha, the Buddhist monastics also in Thailand. Right? And this is one of the main reasons why the Thai Sangha why the Thai monastic order is so incredibly hierarchical these days. With first of all, the Sangha Raja, who is like the Pope. Then you have a kind of a council of 10 elders below that. And then you have all these layers going down in society until at the very bottom you have the ordinary monk, and perhaps these days also the ordinary nun, just doing their thing, just doing their practice. And of course, a hierarchical organization like that, the purpose of the king was to try to have more control over the Sangha, right? To change the way of all the bad monks who were doing the bad things. And the solution of the king is to have a hierarchy. So you have a control through that hierarchy. You promote those people you know who are doing the right thing. You give them titles, right? If you give somebody a title, it is a way of controlling that person. Because as soon as they have a title, you can also take it away. And in the first place, you only give the title to those people who are doing your bidding anyway. So hierarchies and entitlements and titles and all these things are a way of controlling people, trying to control the system. But of course, what happens, and this is what we have been seeing just now with this a scandal in Thailand with possibly the head monk of all Thailand collecting antique Mercedes or whatever, what you see is the downside of that hierarchy. The downside is all the power that gets accumulated by people, all the wealth, right? All the worldliness that comes out into the monastic order, because you have created a monastic order where people are supposed to aspire to all these worldly things, social position, status, money, power, and all these kind of things. That is the natural outcome of a hierarchy. So in one way, what King Mongkut was trying to do, he was trying to reform the Sangha. He was trying to do that, which of course is a very noble thing, because sometimes things go wrong. But instead of actually reforming it according to the Buddha's way of doing things, he decided instead to follow the Catholic Church. Now, if you look at the Catholic Church today, you probably say, gee, but that should be the last place we should look for kind of reform, right? This is probably one of the most kind of dodgy institutions right now. I mean, I'm sure there are many other dodgy as well, but certainly that has been kind of found to be doing many dodgy and bad things. So because of that, if he had known what we know today, he probably would have, you know, cast aside the Catholic Church. But anyway, that's what he did. And it causes problems down to this very day to have these hierarchical structures. In other Buddhist countries, there are similar problems, maybe on a slightly lesser scale. In Sri Lanka, for example, you also have a division of the Sangha, the monastic order, into groups, and they all have the Mahanayaka. Mahanayaka literally means great leader, right? So you have the great leader on the top, and then you have kind of sub-leaders and all these kind of things. So there's some similarities in the Sangha throughout the world. But in Thailand, it is particularly hierarchical, I think, yeah. So what is the Buddha's advice? What should we do in these kind of things? If the Thai government now and the Thai Sangha were to actually really go back to the suttas and take the words of the Buddha seriously, what would they do? What is the right decision? And to understand that, it is quite useful to understand a little bit about how the Buddha laid down the governance of the Sangha. How is the Sangha actually governed? And it's very beautiful way that the Sangha is supposed to be run according to the Buddha's principle. Inspiring way, actually, the way that the Buddha talks about this. And what the Buddha says is that in any monastery here, and the monastery is defined with a boundary, right? It's like a small nation or a small whatever it is, a small kind of territory. So within every monastery is run by the monastics in that monastery here. So when a decision of the Sangha is to be made, a decision of the Sangha means somebody is to be ordained, right? Or somebody is to be installed as an officer of the Sangha to look after maybe the work or the stores or whatever it is. Sometimes you have to give monks some light punishment because they're misbehaving. Punishment in Buddhism means like things like, you know, you have to sit at the end of the line, or you have to you get suspended from the order for a while. There's no physical punishment as such. It's only kind of demotion or whatever. All of these things have to be done by the Sangha as a whole. The Sangha within that monastery has to come together. And the only way that action, that decision of the Sangha is valid, is if the whole Sangha, everybody, every single monk in that monastery has to be present. And every single monk in that monastery has to agree to that action. Right? If one monk raises his hand and says, no, I disagree here, you cannot go ahead. So this is a much higher standard of democracy than we know in the world today. The world today is often called, democracy is often called the tyranny of the majority over the minority, right? Because if the majority wants to tyrannize the minority, well, that's really what ordinary democracy opens up for. But the power of the system of how Sangha is run, everybody has to agree. You have to have a unanimous decision. And if one person disagrees, you cannot actually go through with that. And you may think, oh, this sounds like a recipe for dysfunction, because never ever does everybody agree. But of course, the point is that when you have that system, people adapt to that. People start to understand that they have to listen to what the majority wants, and the majority listens to the minority voice to try to find out what they want, and you find some kind of compromise solution that everybody can live with. And it's powerful, and it creates a lot of harmony. It creates a sense of cohesion in the community when everybody feels that they are heard, and everybody feels that they have a part in that decision. So something about this kind of unanimous, absolute democracy where everybody agrees, that is very, very powerful. And of course, one of the things about that, because every decision is made within every individual monastery, it means there is no hierarchy, right? There's nobody in charge. That monastery is completely self-governing. Nobody from the outside can come and say, well, you made the wrong decision. Because if the Sangha there is confident they did the right thing, and they did it according to the right procedures, also as laid down by the Buddha, it means that it stands. That was a valid decision made by the Sangha. No hierarchy. There is not even an abbot in the early Buddhist text for how to govern the monastic order. There's no abbot even. Every monk in the monastery is essentially on an equal footing. Everybody has a say. Nobody feels left out. And it's a very powerful way of creating harmony in a monastic community. Of course, you may think that this sounds perhaps a little bit dysfunctional. And of course, the reality is that even the Buddha says that we should listen to the elders of the community. So the elders will often carry more of a voice, especially when you have a discussion. Right? So these are also important things to take into account. People with experience, they count more than those who don't have it. But in the end, it is still a democracy in this particular sense. So you can see it is almost the exact opposite of the way Buddhism is functioning today. A flat, completely democratic institution where everybody has a say. No hierarchy whatsoever. After the Buddha, when the Buddha passed away, he was asked, who is going to lead the Sangha after you passed away? And the Buddha says, nobody is going to lead the Sangha after I pass away. After I pass away, it is the Dhamma, the teachings that I have given you, the Vinaya, the monastic law that I have bequeathed to you. This is what is going to run the Sangha and run Buddhism after I have passed away. It is supposed to be a flat structure with no hierarchy. Right? This is the Buddhist idea. And of course, for me, when the Buddha says this is the way we should be running things, this is the way we should be running the monastic order, I take that on board. This is not something that is just an ideal that we should try to... This is not just some kind of ideal. It is something that we actually should try to put into practice. Because if the Buddha says so, it must be a reason for that. And I think the reason is that the Buddha obviously had one of his most important understandings was the understanding of the human mind. He understands the corruption of the human mind, how easily it gets distracted by worldly things, by power, by money, by hierarchies, by prestige, by status. All of these things are very powerful to human beings. And if you are going to try to corrupt the monastic order, the best way to do that is to create a hierarchy which encourages all of these defilements, right? You can be sure that if you create a structure that encourages defilements, the defilements are going to come. That is exactly what we are seeing here. Right? The Buddha is very prescient. He's prescient not because he's looking into the future, because he understands the human mind, how it works right here and right now. So what should they do in Thailand? What is the answer to Thailand? This is going to be very cheeky because I'm going to tell all of Thailand how they should be doing things. So listen, Thailand. No. No, I'm not going to say that. But what I say is that if we really are interested, and this is what King Mongkut was in the middle of the 19th century. He was really interested in how the Buddha would resolve problems. And we should be doing the same thing. So if we are interested in that, if we go back to those suttas, if we go back to the Vinaya that the Buddha gave us, then the answer is that what we should do, not my opinion, the Buddha's opinion, what we should do is to abolish those hierarchies. So the question is not who should become the new Sangha Raja, who should become the new head of the Sangha in Thailand. It's the wrong question. We should abolish that Sangha Raja altogether. No need for a Sangha Raja. Take away the Sangha Raja, take away the entire hierarchy, and allow each monastery to run its own affairs just as it was done at the time of the Buddha. That to me must be the right solution. Not because I think that, but because that was the way that the Buddha said things should be done. Is it going to happen? Of course it's not going to happen. There's no way that this is going to happen in Thailand because the structure is so ingrained, it is so much part of society, there's so many vested interests in that structure, what is there. But still, let us at least have the ideal in the back of the mind and maybe we can move a little bit in that direction. What a wonderful thing that would be if we take the word of the Buddha much more seriously. And of course, in the Western world, in Australia, anywhere else in the world where Buddhism is kind of growing and starting to expand and starting from scratch, let us at least remember that. Let us remember the word of the Buddha and try to live up to that instead of following the way that things have been done in many Buddhist countries over the millennia for whatever cultural reasons. Let's not be too attached to the culture of individual countries, but instead turn our gaze to what the Buddha said and do things in the right way. And then you can perhaps have a monastic order that functions better, which is less corrupt, where there's less problems. Is it going to solve every problem? Of course it isn't going to solve every problem. Of course there will still be corrupt monastics. Of course there will be corrupt lay people. Everything. This is just the nature of how things work. But I think it will work better than the current way, the current situation. And that is really the most important thing. Most lay people understand which monastics should be supported. Most of the lay society understand which monastics are no need to support. And because they understand that, there will be a natural filtering mechanism that happens. And those monastics that deserve support, they will get it. Those who don't deserve support, they will just kind of fade into the background, fade into the shadows gradually. And this is really how this Buddhist teaching, the order of monks and the lay people work together to create a solid foundation for the future. So that is a little bit just on how the Buddha created the monastic order, how the governance of the monastic order actually functions. So this is in itself, I think, a very important aspect. It obviously touches more on the monastics than on the lay people. Still, it also touches really the whole of Buddhism because it is so important for how we function here. I was also going to say a few things about other aspects where I think we have gone wrong in the modern world. And this is, I'm not going to touch on that too much because time, as always, is very short. But one of the most powerful reasons why we should always go back to the word of the Buddha. Remember the Buddha said, when I pass away, the Dhamma, my teachings and the Vinaya, this will be your guide for the future. One of the most important things for that is that we can understand what is real Buddhism and what is unreal Buddhism. The Buddha said that the Dhamma, the teaching of Buddhism, don't fade away. They don't disappear all at once, just like a ship sinks. when a ship sinks, it takes water on board and it goes down very quickly, right? It happens very fast. Glug, glug, and it's kind of gone. Right? I don't know if you've seen it. Sometimes it's amazing how quickly a ship can go down. But the Buddha said, no, that is not actually how Buddhism disappears. Buddhism disappears just as when you have fake gold in the world. When you have fake gold, real gold loses its value. In exactly the same way, when you have fake Dhamma, when you have fake teachings arising in the world, that is when the real Dhamma goes down. Because those fake teachings, they look, wow, it shimmers just like gold, it must be the real thing, right? But actually it isn't. How do we know what the real teachings is? Go back to the source. What did the Buddha say about these things? And then by looking at the source, we can kind of filter out those things that are not original teachings, that maybe, perhaps they are, the fake gold that the Buddha was talking about. What is the fake gold? It's interesting, right? We sometimes need to touch on these subjects, even though it is controversial, and some people are going to jump up and down, and of course they're going to, not going to be interested in this sort of thing. So what are the kind of fake golds I mean when I talk about fake gold? And the very first thing that to me, this is just my personal opinion, I'm not trying to offend anybody by saying this, but the very first type of fake gold, and this was a type of fake gold that arose very soon after the Buddha passed away, that is this whole idea of the Bodhisattva ideal. This idea that instead of practicing the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, we should practice an alternative path, a path called the Bodhisattva path, and we should all aspire to become Buddhas. Sounds very enticing, right? Have compassion for all beings, etc., and become the Buddha yourself. It is also a little bit dangerous because it's also kind of playing a little bit to your ego. Good to be a Buddha, right? That would be pretty cool, right? Being the world teacher, etc. It also plays a little bit to the ego. Why just, you know, practice this simple path when I can do so much good, right, for so many people? Gee, that sounds really nice. So be careful with these kind of things because they are seductive. They seduce you into a worldly way of thinking rather than a way of thinking that accords with the Dhamma. So this is one of the dangers. I think, for me, there is nothing about the Bodhisattva idea in the early suttas. Nothing at all. It's a later idea. It's a very seductive idea. And for that reason, I think it is one of those things that might be called the fake gold that the Buddha was talking about. This is one idea, right? Another idea which I think is can be considered fake gold in Buddhism, and that is the idea of eternalism. The idea that when you pass away, you become an arahant or whatever, you practice the path to the very end. Then when you pass away, you continue on in some kind of eternal state, right? A bit like the Hindu idea of Brahma, a bit like the Christian idea, perhaps, of unity with God, right? Union with God. And you cannot live on in bliss forever after. This is called eternalism in the Buddha suttas. And the Buddha rejects that in very powerful terms. He says the Buddhist idea is the middle way, neither eternalism on the one hand, nor annihilationism, which means you, when you die, when you come to the end of your life, that's it, everything just ends. Neither of those two, it is a middle way in between there, that is the real Buddhist teachings. But when you start to listen to a lot of the Buddhist teachers around the world, this idea of eternalism is rife. It's everywhere in Buddhism, to be found by so many people talking about this. And yet, it is so clearly, again, this is just my opinion, please check it out for yourself, but it's so clearly refuted in the Buddhist suttas. False gold. Why is it false gold? Because it is so seductive. Right? We want to live. Many people want to live in a happy existence forever after, right? Eternalism. Wow. This kind of idea of just going on forever in a happy state. It is so seductive that it is actually can be difficult to take on board the perhaps more sobering message of the Buddha. Anyway, so those are just two ideas which I feel, again, are this idea of false gold arising in the world. And you can see how in all of these situations, what I do, I turn back to the original teachings of the Buddha. I try to do exactly what the Buddha said we should be doing. Going back to the source, going back to the origin, going back to where all these things came from. And then on that basis, try to sort out our modern problems, whether they are problems about views of the Dhamma, whether they are problems of governance, whatever problems they are. Usually you can find the source and the solution in those early suttas. So very, very powerful and important advice the Buddha gave to us. Keep what I have given to you. Keep that. Don't add anything to it. And then you will be fine for the future. Of course, that is actually a very difficult thing to do. So what I'm saying here, perhaps, is that what we need in Buddhism, we need a kind of progressive kind of conservatism. It is conservative in the sense that we go back to the word of the Buddha, we go back to the source, back to the roots of this teaching of Buddhism. But it is progressive in the sense that we try to move towards that ideal. And within that ideal, there's also a lot of scope to actually do things in the right way or the wrong way. The Buddha's teachings are quite flexible. There are many things, there are many different things you can do. You can use the internet to promote the teachings, which the Buddha society here has been very good at. All of these things that we actually can do within that scope. So we have to be progressive while at the same time being conservative. So progressive conservatism is, I think, one of those key things that we should look for as Buddhists. So that's why we should have bhikkhunis. Bhikkhunis, because that is part of the ancient heritage, right? It's what the Buddha taught. And it's also part of a progressive agenda in the modern world. It is madness not to have that sense of equality in the Buddhist Sangha, in my opinion. We're not going to be taken seriously if you don't do that. But the last thing, and the last thing which I found is very, has always found very fascinating about this advice that the Buddha gives us. One of the things the Buddha says, one of the things he says that are important for the safeguarding of Buddhism in the future, he says that as long as the Sangha, as long as the monastics, as long as the monks and nuns delight and rejoice in forest lodgings, so long will Buddhism prosper in the world. Right? It is very powerful. It is, I'm sure you probably agree that yes, living in the forest, going away from society, practice meditation, all of these things are no doubt very important. But in fact, it is so important, the Buddha says, that it is one of the things that ensures the long-term survival and the prosperity of Buddhism for the future. That is how important it is. It's important to remember these things. It is important to remember that, because if we remember these things again, we know the sort of institutions that we have to support, the sort of things that we have to nurture, to encourage, to make this possible, to ensure that Buddhism actually does last a long time in the future. This doesn't mean that monastics who live in the city or who are, do all kinds of social work or educational work, that is useless or no good or doesn't really matter. Of course, that has its own value. The point rather is that the true Buddhism is served and nurtured and established and upheld and prospers because of the forest dwellings of the monastic Sangha. So remember that. That is how powerful it is. You may have heard, there's quite a famous, not famous, but it's famous because Ajahn Brahm likes to quote this sutta. There's a sutta somewhere in the Anguttara Nikaya, and this is quite, I think, sometimes quite surprising to people. And this sutta, the Buddha is kind of walking around and he sees this monk, right? He sees this monk who is sitting at the edge of a village, right? Sitting kind of in meditation, very straight, right? Meditation obviously going quite well, right? So what do you think the Buddha says about this monk? You probably think he says, well done, your meditation is going well, okay, good on you. The Buddha doesn't say that. What the Buddha says, I am not happy with this monk. Why? Because he's sitting in meditation in the wrong place. He's sitting on the edge of the village. Before you know it, he will be disturbed by the people around him. He will be enticed by the sensual pleasures around him. And he will be drawn out of his meditation practice. Then the Buddha goes into the forest and he sees this monk in the forest, really tired, right? Nodding away. You know what I mean, nodding away, right? You see this all the time, people nodding away here. Actually, if you want to nod away here on Friday, please nod here on Friday night. It is perfectly allowable. At least you are relaxing, right? Which always is a very good sign here. One of my very close monastic friends, he always says that every time he sits down to meditate, he starts off by nodding. 10 minutes nodding. And then after he nods for 10 minutes, his mind clears up. And then he meditates well afterwards. So nodding is not a bad thing here. So the Buddha goes into the forest, he sees this monk nodding away here. And people sometimes think, oh, he would have told him off. Sit straight, for goodness sake. It says in the Anapanasati Sutta, put your back straight. That's how you meditate. This is the wrong way to meditate. You can't go nodding like that. No, the Buddha says exactly what I was saying now, pretty much. That this monk, he is doing the right thing. I praise this monk. Why? Because he's sitting in the right place. He's sitting in the forest. He will soon overcome that tiredness. He nods for a few minutes. He will overcome the tiredness. And then he will be able to meditate properly. Nobody will disturb him. Nobody will detract from his meditation. And he will be able to progress on the path because of that. Right? It's kind of upside down from what many people think things should be here. That is the importance of living in the forest. It draws you out of the city, draws you out of all the hustle and bustle, all the noise and all the problems of the city, draws you away from the sensual pleasures of the city. Right? When you travel around the city, you see all these advertisements everywhere, you see kind of couples walking around hand in hand, you see all kind of stuff that are not really very helpful as a monastic, right? So you withdraw from that, and you draw into the forest instead. And of course, one of the powerful things about the forest is that there isn't, because there aren't many things to entice you in a real forest monastery, it means you have to source your happiness. You have to source your meaning of life from something else. It must come from something inside of you rather than outside. Right? So when you see that somebody lives in the forest for year after year, for decade after decade, sometimes in complete solitude, without seeing anybody, you think, wow, how is that possible? Drive most people crazy. Right? And you know that the only way that is possible is because they are drawing from a power inside of themselves. A power of samadhi, a power of happiness, a power of meditation, a power of insight that allows them to live a life where they actually are much more happy staying by themselves in the forest than they are to have anything to do with people, the city, busyness and all these other kind of things. So this is the example of the forest, of living in the forest. And of course, because of that, it is in when you meditate in seclusion, in that kind of situation, that is when you can expect to find those deep insights in yourself. First of all, the deep peace, the profound samadhi, the profound meditations. And from that, the arising of deep insights come. That can be expected to be found in the forest, not in the city. And because of that, because those deep insights, the same understanding the Buddha had 2,500 years ago, you can access directly that same understanding, particularly in the forest. That is why the forest tradition, the monastics, or even the lay people for that matter, who practice far away like that, that is where Buddhism will be upheld, because that is the only place you are likely to be able to realize the word of the Buddha in exactly the same way the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago. And of course, when you realize that, when you see what the Buddha taught, it means you can go out into the world and tell the world, explain exactly what it is like. Your appearance will have changed. You will be a different person. You will be full of compassion and loving kindness. You will have no anger anymore, no desires. You won't be looking for vintage Mercedeses anymore, right? Hooray! No more vintage Mercedeses. Get rid of that burden. And you will shine forth those qualities that are the qualities of a real person who has understood those things. And this is why this forest lodgings, supporting the Sangha in the forest, is so important, both now and also in the future. And this is one of the things we should remember here at the Buddha Society, that we also support the right kind of monasticism and also the right kind of practice for the lay people, often coming together in this way. And if we do that, if we remember these basic things, going back to the word of the Buddha, trying to understand how the Buddha taught things, trying to apply the understanding the Buddha had, and we ensure that the monasticism is practiced in the right way, and we do this with a sense of conservatism, going back to the source, but also with a sense of flexibility, a sense of progressiveness, where we use these things in a wise way so as to match with our present society, then I think we are on the right path. And then we will have Buddhism for a long, long time in the future, here in Australia, but also everywhere else around the world. Okay, thank you very much. That's the talk for this evening here. Okay, so now you have a chance to complain about all the things that I have said, all the bad things or the good things or whatever it is. Is there a microphone for John Treasure over here? John Treasure would like to ask a question here. Yeah.
Hello?
You just lost the lead. Yeah, the cord. Yeah.
Hello? You used the word in the forest. You know, emphasize that a lot. But monks who are practicing well in Tibet, they've got no forest, right?
Yeah.
So I think, isn't that the misused word? Just because that might be in the time of the Buddha, but okay. Nowadays it's spread all over the world and in different environments.
Yeah, so it's true. I don't really mean the forest. I guess what I mean is the wilderness, away from the city, away from the ordinary things of the world. And the Pali word aranya, which is the word I'm talking about here, is really a word which means not of the king. So outside of the king's reach, in other words, outside of civilized society, is really what it means. So it means like, yeah, you're quite right. Forest is too narrow. I agree with that. Yes, over here. Do we have a microphone over here, please? Any microphone tonight? Thanks, Drew. No microphones? Okay. Just go for it. I'll repeat it on the thing here. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Is there an app for it? Yeah. Okay. I'll repeat what you said. That's okay. So he's asking here, how do we access the original word of the Buddha? Is there an app for that? You're asking the wrong person about apps. I have no idea about this kind of stuff. I don't even have a mobile phone, anything like that. So I have no idea. But it's actually quite simple, because if you go to the Pali, what is called the Pali Canon, which basically is the canon of Buddhist suttas preserved in the Pali language, there are four main texts there, called the Long Discourse of the Buddha, the Middle-Length Discourse of the Buddha, the Connected Discourse of the Buddha, and the Numerical Discourse of the Buddha. They're all available in the library over here, four collections, and you cannot get much closer to the original word of the Buddha than that. I'm not going to go into why, but there are very sound historical reasons for that. You can see the development of scriptures, and you can see what the core root are of all of these things. If you go to those four, you're very, very close to it. Long discourses, mid-length discourses, connected discourses, numerical discourses, and you're in business. Yeah? Okay. Yes. There's a microphone coming your way here. Yeah?
I see what you're saying about the original teachings, how, you know, it's good for everyone to go back to that. What about things, I don't know what actually the Buddha's position on this was, but what about things that do need to change with times, like equality of women and making nuns equal to monks, things like that.
Yeah.
Like, isn't there also a place where, you know, things, as things progress in society, you do need to change?
Sure. Indeed. And this is one of the things about the Buddhist teaching. They're actually quite flexible. They're not as square and as kind of has to be this way as you might think, but the flexibility there. And one of the things that when we had the ordination of bhikkhunis here, 7 years ago, whatever it is now, one of the things is that you look at those teachings, is it allowable in the present day to ordain women as nuns, basically as the equivalent of monks? And if you look at them, they're actually quite flexible, and there's no doubt in my mind that within the scope of that, it is actually possible to do that. But then you can take another approach, and you can take an approach which is more conservative and say, oh no, you know, throughout the centuries, various teachers have said this and that. But I say, no, let's go back to the word of the Buddha. And the word of the Buddha tends to be very reasonable and very, very useful in that way. There is a lot of flexibility in there. And I think that if we use the word of the Buddha in the right way, I don't think that we actually have to go beyond, I don't think we have to, go against the word of the Buddha. I think we can use it in such a way and have that equality between men and women, both in the lay community and also in the Sangha, almost on equal terms. There are a few things in there which look on the surface of it not to be quite equal, but these are things we just need to study more and find out whether actually they are really come from the Buddha or not. So I think, again, conservatism but progressiveness, right? The two things together actually, I think, work very well here. Yeah. Okay, anyone else wants to say anything? Yeah. Going, yeah. Yes? Eddie, a reliable questioner, okay, always there. Okay.
Yeah, Ajahn Brahmali.
Mm.
About the future of Buddhism.
Yes.
In the broader, wider sense, you know.
In the what?
In the broader sense.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah. This is only what I heard. I don't know how true it is. And I don't know whether you heard of this or not, okay? They say altogether, there are 28 Buddhas.
Mm.
And Sakyamuni Buddha, he's the 27th of the 28 Buddha.
Mm.
Okay? And in this cycle, this current cycle, there are 5 Buddhas. He is the 4th of the 5th Buddha. Yeah, and then they say that the 5th Buddha, Maitreya Buddha, will come down when the world is in turmoil. You know. He'll come to save the world. You know. And after that, the world will plunge into darkness. When I heard this, I thought, it's similar to the 2nd coming of Christ.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or could it be from Hinduism?
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
All of that stuff is just legend, it's mythology, it is things that have been made up long time after the Buddha. The Buddha doesn't say anything about this. This, for me, this comes from the craving, the desire, the fear in people's hearts. Where will we be? Where shall we stand? There is no Buddha anymore. And then you make up these stories. I'm well-intentioned. I'm not saying that people have bad intentions or anything like that. Maybe they have some nimitta, some sign in the meditation practice. Oh, I saw the future Buddha in my meditation, right? And then they write a book about that. Future Buddha has been seen, right? And you see this long list of Buddhas into the future. So please don't buy into these kind of things. This to me is just the craving, the desire in people's heart for security, for a sense that the future, I will be okay in the future, right? I won't be without the Buddha. That is what to me, this is all a sign of. So I would not take those things seriously at all if I were you. Yeah. Okay, anyone else wants to say anything? Yeah. Everybody happy? Yeah, going? Yeah, no? Bill? Sorry? Yes, that is coming next. I'm just giving you guys a chance first of all, and then we move on to the from overseas. Okay, so this is from overseas. This is from Cow in the USA. About future Buddhas, when is it believed another Buddha will come? Is it not until the dissolution of this world system, or could it be in our current universe? I don't know the answer to that, and I think that there are lots of contradictory things said in various places about how these things happen. I read a little bit about the Amagata Vangsa, which is the lineage of future Buddhas, and to me it is just a whole load of ideas or superstition, basically things that people have thought up. Yes, there will be a future Buddha. We don't know when it will be here. Of course there will be a future Buddha, but the reason that there is a future Buddha in itself is not superstition, because the future Buddhas are just a natural phenomenon that arises in the world. Every now and again somebody breaks through the veil of delusion, they see reality as it actually is, and that person then becomes a Buddha. But let's forget about these Buddhas. It doesn't matter if we start to argue about whether it's in this universe or after the dissolution of this universe. We are already on the wrong track. That is not where the question lies. The question is really to forget about all of that and focus on the present teachings. There is one mention of the Buddha Maitreya in one of the early suttas found in the Pali Canon. And I think it has been shown quite decisively by scholars that is a late intrusion into the Pali Canon. And if that is correct, that means that there is no mention in any suttas in early Buddhism about future Buddha Maitreya. Right? So basically, it doesn't come from the Buddha. It comes from later generations. And as such, we have good grounds for being skeptical. So I apologize for not being too helpful there, but that's how it goes. Okay, this is from Raymond in Germany. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, what do you think of Zen? Okay, what do you think of Zen? Zen Buddhism is the Japanese form of Buddhism, and it is derived, Zen is a formation, Japanese formation from the word Chan. The word Chan is the word used in China. Chan Buddhism is one of the largest denominations of Buddhism in China, right? And then it went from China to Korea, from Korea to Japan. So kind of moving along, and as it moved along, the name changed a little bit as it moved along here. And Chan, the word Chan in China, is actually the same word that we have in Theravada Buddhism. It is derived from the word Jhana. Right? Have you heard the word Jhana before? Right? If you are a good disciple of the Buddha, you would have heard the word, good disciple of Ajahn Brahm, I should say, you would have heard the word Jhana many, many times. It's one of his, he talks about Jhanas and the deep meditation states, right? So the ideas behind Chan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism are actually quite good. They're very similar to the ideas that are rooted in the idea of Jhana, of deep states of meditation. Whether they actually achieve that and how deep they go and all these kind of things, you would really have to, I guess, go to Japan and study these things. I don't really know much about Zen Buddhism myself. You hear all these fearsome stories of the Zen master going around with a stick and hitting people over the head if they fall asleep. But I'm sure that isn't all there is to it. There's all these koans and all this kind of stuff. But of course, there are many different practices also in Zen Buddhism, and exactly where it is, I don't actually know, so sorry about that. I just recommend you find a good book on the topic and see what you can find out from that. Okay, last one is from Paul in England. How should we regard Nibbana from the position of me wanting to gain awakening? I find it hard to reconcile the notion of it with the current attachment to life. Right, so how should we regard Nibbana? So first of all, please don't want to be enlightened, right? Wanting to be enlightened is going to often be an obstacle in your meditation practice. The most important thing in meditation is just to chill, just to enjoy, relax, sit back. Wow, this is so nice. Right, I'm sitting here in this wonderful Buddha society in Perth. It's amazing how that we have such a great Buddha society here in Perth. Wow, what a wonderful thing, all these people around me who are all kind of heading in the right direction. Great teachers like Ajahn Brahm. Wow, it doesn't get much better than this. So you build yourself up into a positive state of mind, just enjoying the present, not worrying about awakening or enlightenment in the future. This is really the first thing. The more we desire things for the future, the more we crave for our meditation to be good, the less good that meditation is going to be. It's just about enjoying the present moment. That is really what meditation is all about. And then it goes deeper by itself. So how can we reconcile this notion with our current attachment to life? And remember the reason why you are attached to life is because you haven't understood things properly here. You don't really see things in the way that the Buddha sees things. Remember that one of the important things of the Buddha, the first noble truth, is a noble truth of suffering, right? Dukkha. Now, if you understand the noble truth of dukkha, doesn't mean, I hit my foot this morning when I was walking out, I have a bit of a headache today, I argued with my wife, or, my children are misbehaving, all this. This is dukkha, of course, but that is not what the Buddha means by understanding dukkha fully here. Understanding dukkha, suffering fully, is a matter of insight. It's a different viewpoint of the world. You're seeing the world in an entirely new way. This is what it's about. So the reason why you are attached to life is because you haven't had that insight yet. You haven't seen the world according to the way the Buddha sees the world. Once you understand the way the Buddha sees the world, you understand that Nibbana is only one thing. It's only one thing that matters. And what Nibbana is, it is the end of suffering. That's all it is. That's all you have to think of it as. If you don't get to Nibbana, you don't end suffering here. You will continue on in the cycle of existence, going here, going there, doing all kinds of things. It is only by attaining Nibbana that you actually end suffering here. Otherwise you can't end it. Right? So the question is then, you know, you can keep on living and suffering, or you can attain Nibbana and not suffer. That's really the question. And if you start to understand the Dhamma more profoundly, you understand ideas such as non-self, of course you're going to choose non-suffering. Why? Who would choose suffering if you can have the highest happiness attainable? Nibbanang paramang sukhang. Nibbana is the highest happiness. One of those phrases that you see in the suttas every now and again. Right? So it's because of misunderstanding. So try to understand the Buddha's teachings. Try to gradually change your view of these things. And as you do that, you start to understand how Nibbana actually is, why it is such a powerful draw card and why it is so important, and why it actually works despite our delusions to the contrary here. Okay, so that is all for this evening. So let us just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavanta